And I was broken. I was having panic attacks. I was really, really struggling to hold it together. And I was like, what the f*** am I doing this sh- for?
Final straw that just cracked it.
And I made a decision then that I was closing the businesses that Christmas.
I'm here today in King's Cross with the legend that is Joe Mills. Our day was, it was awful, wasn't it?
You'd have to clean the shop top to bottom every day. Saturday, deep clean, screamed and shouted at. And I remember having that moment going, I'm not going back. And I went in there thinking that I was the bee's knees and all of a sudden went, all right, okay, there's a whole different standard way above me.
I mean, my memory of it, Lounge took off.
Instantly.
Really did seem like an overnight thing.
Within 3 months, we were fully booked. Every chair was full. And I remember literally crying. You don't understand what this is doing to me. To you guys, this is all a f***ing joke. Most people my age are winding down, not winding up. I'm accelerating. I know what I'm doing now. Where I am today is the most happy I've been for many, many years.
Hi, welcome to the Noble Barber Podcast. I'm Anthony Laban, and we'll be talking to various people in the industry who've made it and their journey and how they got here. Talking honest, cutting through the crap, and making sure your story and their story is heard to help your business and hopefully mine. If you haven't already, please hit the subscribe button and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi there. Welcome to another episode of the Noble Barber Podcast. I'm Anthony Laban and this is another one of our special deep dives. I'm here today in King's Cross with the, not an overused word, the legend that is Joe Mills. Lovely to see you, Joe. Hi, mate. Thank you very much.
Pleasure, man.
I use the word legend not in any level of sarcasm, but there's a bit in there in the fact that really you were one of the kind of big lads in the 90s, really. And so that to me was one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you, that your career spanned not just spanned a long time, but has been innovative and interesting throughout that time. But if you wouldn't mind, I always like to kind of dig back a bit earlier. I know you're a Margate lad, but can we just recap as to, you know, young Joe growing up, what your parents were about and that kind of thing?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for coming to chat with me. Always appreciate your time. I think really it kind of starts in about 1977 and moving to Margate. Before that, I grew up in Woking with my mum and dad and my sister. But we moved down to Margate and my parents, I think, always wanted their own business, and they bought a guest house on Margate Seafront. And my childhood, I remember, like, it's weird as well that I think this is a real common thread, that how you remember your childhood versus how your parents remember your childhood. I remember having a moan at them in my 20s about, you were never there, and they were like, but we weren't open in the winter. We were there all the time. But yeah, so we grew up in Margate.
From at what age? When did you leave Woking?
I was about just nearly eight.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so really for me, you know, Margate's kind of the bit that I kind of really identify with and remember. My parents had, like I said, a guest house on Margate Seafront, and they were, you know, working all from Easter all the way through to the end of the summer season. And I remember them opening a couple of Christmases as well. So we had we lived in this guest house, this big, it was like a small hotel, but it was, you know, Christmas, you know, you'd have a room, like a house full of guests.
Excellent.
So it was quite mad. But and my parents were really, really focused on them having a business. You know, it was, they were all in. It wasn't something you could, so I had a very, very strong understanding of work ethic from a young age. And my childhood was pretty cool, you know, usual stuff. You know, didn't particularly excel at school, you know, it was far more of a creative than I ever was academic.
And we see Margate now as this very cool arty Tracy Emin tape Margate world. How was it in the 70s and 80s?
Well, I think up to a point it was quite cool, because you know, it was that time before, and anyone of a certain age will know the name, it was before Freddie Laker. Freddie Laker was this guy that all of a sudden started doing cheap package holidays to Spain, to Benidorm, stuff like that. Before that, it was almost unobtainable for a lot of working class. So all of those seaside towns, whether it's Hastings, Margate, all of those places were really, really popular. We used to have a lot of, I remember a lot of our guests were from Scotland and Tyneside and like Manchester. A lot of the from the north would come down to the south for their summer holidays, and you do a week or 2 weeks at a hotel.
Yeah.
And you know, it had a, you know, the seafront was buzzing. It was a really cool place to grow up. One of my biggest memories is that feeling of in the winter regaining your town, because in the winter everything closed down, everything got boarded up. You know, kind of, it was that kind of weird transition from, you know, in the summer there's like candy floss and donkeys on the beach and all of that.
From Vegas to ghost town.
Yeah, and I liked the winter months.
Yeah,
that kind of like, you know, the freedom to roam around and do what you wanted to do. You know, kind of muddled my way through school, and you know, I had a great bunch of mates and all that kind of stuff. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. My parents moved away from when the holiday industry started to die, and you know, we had the recession and stuff like that. I knew it was tough because both mum and dad had other jobs as well, and I knew that it was, it wasn't an easy ride for them. And then my parents were both very interested in sort of welfare and mental health. And they started looking after people in the hotel that had been long-term institutionalized in, it was when they were doing this whole care in the community and they were shutting down hospitals for people that had mental health issues. So my parents kind of adapted their business into that. And then that became a all year round 24-hour day.
And you were still living there at that point?
Yeah, my parents then bought a house nearby, and the family moved into the house. And then my parents then sold that hotel and bought a bigger one further up the road, and that became their thing. But it was, you know, looking back, I was given, both me and my sister were given a lot of freedom. She's a little bit younger than me. We were given a lot of freedom in the right way. Do you know what I mean? As long as they knew where we were, who we were with, it was all cool. Pre-mobile phones, obviously. But, you know, whoever got home first would, you know, start dinner or, you know, unload the washing machine. You were very independent. But, you know, always felt very, very supported. And even, you know, with, you know, encouraged to go and get, you know, Saturday jobs and to work.
But quite unusual at that time for, I mean, not the graft. I mean, hey, obviously that showed your folks and that kind of graft idea has obviously stuck with you.
100%.
But it was quite unusual in that period to be, I don't know, entrepreneurial, starting businesses. You know, that's kind of pre-Thatcher, Great Britain and all that kind of stuff.
Correct.
That was quite an unusual thing to do. You were meant to be a company boy at that point.
Yeah, and I think because my dad, he left school and did an apprenticeship and worked in the print. And mum had, you know, worked in the NHS. And, you know, I remember some of my youngest memories, my dad left the print and was a Unigate milkman. And I remember I've got one memory of sitting in a milk float with my dad and going out early in the morning while he did his deliveries. But I must have been sort of maybe five.
My granddad was a milkman.
Yeah.
Excellent.
But I think them, the entrepreneurial spirit was, we want to work for, you know, I think this is a common mistake that we'll probably touch on throughout the conversation and the conversations we've had in the past. I think you open your own business thinking you're going to have more time, you have more flexibility, and you can get to that point. And I think my parents probably felt that they were going to have that. We'll open for the summer holidays and then the winters we'll spend with the kids. But the truth of that doesn't always translate. So, you know, my memories of Margate, it was, you know, it went into a decline after the whole kind of
mid-80s time.
Yeah. And it was really run down. Mm. And now you're right, it's, you know, it's hipster central and it's really cool. And it's great to see the reinvestment.
It's really
down
done
there.
That whole kind of Britannia, and it's back.
Yeah.
Apprenticeship? Was that Margate? Where did you say you went full hairdressing apprenticeship, didn't you?
Yeah, so I was quite into, like, I used to go to the barbers with my dad, and my mum used to go to this shop that was more of a unisex salon. And then as, you know, fashions changed and I wanted highlights and a wedge or whatever the haircut was at the time, I started going to my mum's salon, and I really kind of liked that whole kind of vibe. And I was umming and ahhing about what I wanted to do, and I had this thing about, I was quite into acting at school and was kind of explored that, but realized that, you know, it was going to be a slog. And I was like, well, you know, and kind of flirted with being a social worker and all sorts of things, which kind of, I guess we do.
Yeah, I was going to say, most hairdressers think they're rock stars or actors, don't they?
Yeah, and then, I came up to leaving school, and a friend of a friend to my parents recommended this guy who had a couple of shops in the area. And I went to him. His name was Gert Renzenbrink. He was a Dutch New Zealander and phenomenal haircutter. And I got an apprenticeship there, and I left school early. So I left at the Easter and then had to go back to sit my exams, my O-levels and whatever. And yeah, went into an apprenticeship for just hairdressing. Yeah.
See, we're having lots of conversations about apprentices at the moment. And I think we all look back on our apprenticeships with this kind of weird rose-tinted glasses.
Oh, mine was brutal.
Did you? I mean, the way I train and bring my team through now is very, it's like the polar opposite of how I was trained. And I wouldn't wish that. I hear a lot of, oh, they don't do like in my day. And our day was awful, wasn't it? Was yours much the same?
I think it was 2 days a month day release to get my city and guilds in those days. And then it was all in salon. And he was a really hard taskmaster. You know, there was, I think it was two or three of us, and, you know, you'd have to clean the shop top to bottom every day, Saturday deep clean, you know, you'd be on your feet all day and scream and shout out. You know, I remember literally, I must have only just joined. And I remember having that moment going, I'm not going back. And my mum went, you are. And I was like, I'm not. And she was like, no, you are. You're not walking out. And sort of rode it out. It was interesting though, because I can look back at certain elements of it. So he was really, really focused on promoting his business. So he wanted me to enter hairdressing competitions, like the old school style. And
which was kind of live creating.
Correct. And they still exist now.
In a room
now,
of 60, 70, 100 people. Yeah.
So we did all the like British championships. Like I won, you know, I did all the Kent ones, South England one, you know, was fortunate, won quite a few, got placed quite a lot. And like I remember driving, being in the back of the car with my hair model and driving to Derby. And like, you know, we would go all over the country and we would be like practicing late at night with him. And, you know, and it all seemed like that stuff I kind of enjoyed, and I, you know, the support and the mentorship I guess he gave me was really, really beneficial. But I knew that my time with him was definitely running out. But he would do things like, I remember he used to have this woman, I used to have to blow dry her hair. She had really thick hair, and he would have a prearranged conversation with her. So I'd be three quarters of the way through and she'd go, no, I don't want it like that. I've changed my mind. And she would literally make my life a misery. But then looking back, at the time, I was literally like, you know, wanted to hurl my hairdryer through the window or whatever. But now, understanding that you learn to cope and you learn that resilience. So there would, you know, I'd never treat my assistants like I was treated ever. I wouldn't even enter my
psyche. And quite rightly.
100%.
Yeah, the young coming through are still just as kind of turned on by the creative stuff as you were.
Yeah.
You know, who's going to get too excited about cleaning a skirt and ball with a toothbrush? Whereas, you know, bouncing around the country trying to create something. So you qualified. Was that your moment to leave Margate, or did you carry on?
No, not at all. No, so during the back end of my training with him.
3 years?
Two and a bit.
Right.
I'd got my city in guilds and I was comfortable. And I'd done some courses. I'd come to London and he'd sent me on some courses. Kind of felt that I was, you know, capable. But being a straight guy, cutting hair in Margate, I had to learn how to cut all my mates' hair. And I had a lot of mates who were kind of, you know, kind of rockabillies and had quiffs and flat tops and had to learn how to fade. And then I kind of really enjoyed that. And I was still doing things like, you know, pre-lightening like my mates' hair. And so I was doing that. And there was a barber shop in Ramsgate that I managed to get a job in. So I went there and it was just a, you know, walk-in barbershop. There was six or eight of us. And we just literally, you know, just got stuck in and, you know, all day, every day. And really kind of cut my teeth, you know, doing, you know, 15, 30 minute wet down haircuts.
So that whole kind of psychobilly, that was when the kind of pompadours and all
correct.
These kind of
yeah,
things
yeah, yeah.
were really flying out. That was...
Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, you had the bit of the back, you know, the kind of the start of the rave scene as well. And, you know, we're doing perms and stuff like that. And, you know, it was a really interesting time fashion wise. There was a lot of different kind of subcultures that were really blowing up, so you had to be quite quite fashion aware and adept. So for me it was really interesting. And then I then got a, I moved to another store in Broadstairs, a store called Malcolm's, and the guy run it called Malcolm. There's a really amazing bunch of barbers there, and he was our boss. And I wasn't there for a long time, but a real marked impression on me. That real kind of like on a Saturday, we'd finish at four and we'll go to the park and play football, go to the pub on a Friday night. You know, that, there was
kind
a real
family kind of thing.
And I still pop in from time to time and see Malk, and you know, there's a couple of faces I still remember.
Store still going?
Yeah, I think he's sold it. He's because he's quite a bit older than me. I'm 56. I think he must be 10 years older than me. And I think he's got out, or he still cuts hair there one day a week. I don't know. But I haven't been down there for a little while. But last time I was down there, I popped in and said hi to him. And
old barbers never die, they just fade away.
Exactly. And then I was kind of going out with this girl called Tanya, and she had this opportunity to work in London for a pub chain that was. Had pubs in Margate and Broadstairs, but they had one in London, and she was going to go and run this pub, and I was like, "Oh fuck it, I'll move to London." And then we kind of moved up to London and kind of didn't really know anyone and kind of, you know, sort of struggled our way along, and I got a job in the city originally at a store called Cops. It was one of the oldest barbers in the city of London.
So very. Traditional barber.
Yeah, and it was run by a group of old school Jewish barbers that had all either had their shops and sold them or retired and would do one or two days a week. We used to get a lot of politicians, like guys from the FT, and it was on Bow Lane, and I was the young, you know, they used to call me the goy, the young non-believer, and they were you know, they were a hard bunch of guys to be around, and I you know, sort of kind of cut my teeth, learned how to shave there. Stuff that I hadn't really been exposed to, because, you know, wet shaves and stuff like that wasn't really a thing in barbering at that point. It kind of died away. And, yeah, you know, kind of tried to find my way in London and all that kind of stuff, and knew that I wanted more, and knew that, you know, we start work at 7 a.m, finish at 4, and we were doing, you know, kind of didn't have to work weekends.
And no Saturdays.
Saturdays. So I used to go back to Malcolm's and cut hair on a Saturday. So I still kept
the
my foot
work
in.
Work ethic.
Yeah, kept my foot. But also as well, there was that kind of fear. Mm. Do you know what I mean? You're like, you know, you're a little fish in a really big pond in London. And I was really like, you know, what happens if it doesn't work out? You know, for lots of different reasons. And then.
And you're how old at this point? You're in your
21.
20s? Yeah.
21, yeah.
But you're feeling established in your skills, presumably, by now.
Oh, I thought I was Billy Big Bollocks. And it was interesting going to Cops, like, you know, they, you know, I could cut long hair. I could do I could do a lot of different work that they couldn't, but they could do things that I couldn't. So there's a lot of skill sharing. From my perspective, I learned a lot there and learned a lot about that kind of culture that even at Malcolm's in Broadstairs, there was, I don't know, a bunch of, we're all the same age, we're in our 20s, you know what I mean? There wasn't that kind of institutionalized barbering, you know, and, you know, is what it is. But yeah, and so, yeah, and I remember going home to my parents one weekend, and I'd picked a copy of The Face Up, the magazine that at the time was like, you know, like a Bible, you know, had everything in it. And this is obviously before the internet. And there was a photo shoot in there of a guy called Paul Burford, who owned Fish Hairdressing in Soho, and he was doing a haircut with a Stanley knife, and it was like about the, you know, the new mod and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, fuck it, I want to work there, fuck it, that's where I'm going. And then I aggressively chased it. So I remember calling him up and blagging him that I'd met him, and got an interview. And so left Cops 4 o'clock one afternoon, went there, got an interview, did a trade test and got a job. And then, you know, then my life, that's when who I am now as a hairdresser, barber, whatever you want to identify me as, that's where that journey really started.
I think for a lot of people, you know, Fish maybe doesn't collate as a brand so much.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was properly, I got there in 91. Leading that whole period, the kind of Paul Weller cool,
yeah,
Brit, you know, Cool Britannia and all that kind of,
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was right in the center with maybe them and Cuts, maybe.
Yes, it was us and Cuts.
You know, they were the two brands that were flying.
Yeah. So we were on Darblay Street, and you had Duff of St. George was there. That was their first store. There was us, there was Black Market Records, the pub called The George, which was always like a precursor to everyone's Saturday night.
Yeah.
Everyone went to the George first and Friday night. But it was a real, that street was, you know, like the spot. Mm. And, you know, all the clients came in TV, film, music, you know, cool fashion kids, like, you know, DJs. It was really, you know, and I went in there thinking that I was the bee's knees and all of a sudden went, all right, okay, there's a whole different standard way above me. So it really pushed me to like really find my niche, find where I was comfortable and really develop. And
but did it feed that kind of fashion urge that you'd had previously with your kind of psychobilly pals? Had that always stayed with you, that fashion was, that barbering was your road into fashion?
It kind of, I don't think I thought about it like that. I think it felt that it was hand in hand. Like the fact that we all dressed in Duffer of St. George and all went to the right club or whatever it was, and hair tied in with that. It wasn't as if, I actually felt that both Cuts and Fish at the time were leading fashion as opposed to following fashion.
Yeah.
I think that we had people that were opinion makers and formers as trends changed very early on. So a lot of what we did was very... you know, it just felt a natural progression.
Yeah. I mean, Fish was the first brand I remember having their own brand of products. I mean, Cuts,
so it was in
the
boots
same
and
times
stuff.
were releasing. I think James Cuts had James Le Bon had a top 10 hit.
Yeah,
it was a hugely vibrant point in Soho's history.
Yeah, it was, and I was really fortunate that, you know, there was a great bunch of guys and girls in there, and we all, you know, all from different, you know, backgrounds, stuff like that, we all got on. I got quite heavily involved in the club scene as well, and was DJing and putting parties on in London, and we were doing parties all over the place. So I had the kind of my daytime, which was, you know, flat out cutting hair, and then evenings putting parties on and running clubs. And it really was a really exciting kind of environment to be in, and the people you met. And it was a great, you know, I learned a great lesson then about networking, about meeting people, and, you know, like going, oh, you know, tying people together. And it really kind of set me on the right path.
Yeah. And you stayed with Fish for
9 years. Yeah, 9 years.
And ended up from new boy to pretty much running the place almost.
Yeah, there was a couple of us there was me and Vicky. We're kind of overseeing. Vicky was the main manager, and then there was me kind of helping out. And yeah, it was a really good time. I knew that I wanted more, and I knew that I wanted my own business. I don't know why I thought that was the right thing to do, but I was also mindful of that, you know, I was sort of 27, you know, coming up to 28, and I was like, okay, there's only so much I can earn here. There's only so much I can do here. You know, it's not, you know, and my nickname used to be Jay Fish, you know, to my mates. And I was like, it's not mine. It's Paul's. It's not mine. So I wanted ownership over something as well. And I remember going out to see my parents and saying, look, I've got this idea. You know, what do you think? And they weren't in a position to invest in me. And also as well, I don't think they thought I was serious enough at the time, because I had lots of other, you know, I was putting parties on and going to Cyprus and Ibiza and DJing and stuff. So it was all a bit, really, you're going to want to open a shop. And looking back now, I get it. At the time, I took it as a bit of a, like, you know, punch in the nose. I was a bit like, great, thanks very much for that. But now I get it.
But you set up
the lounge.
The lounge. Was that in competition with Fish? It was very close by.
Fish was on Diablo Street, and you used to walk down Barrett Street through the market, and there was a street called Peter Street, which is now where you've got Supreme, Bone Daddies, you know, it's, you know, Palace around the corner. It's super,
it's cool again.
But then it was crackheads, brothels and sex shops. And if you said Peter Street, no one would know the name of the street. If you went where all the brothels are, they'd go, oh, I know where you mean. So a client had a cobbler's, a shoe repair shop down there, and he wanted out. Him and his brother had fallen out. He wanted out, and he wanted 12 grand key money. And it belonged to Westminster Council, so the rent was dirt cheap.
Right.
And I stupidly was out one night, and I had a few pints and started talking about it to someone who knew Paul, my boss. And he found out and obviously, you know, chucked his toys out of the pram and sacked me. And it was all very messy. And it was, you know, and I had like, and I was like, okay, I'm out of a job and I've got my shop's not, I haven't even got my shop. I've got an idea, but I haven't got any money. You know, my parents aren't going to back it. What the hell am I going to do? And I worked for another guy called Russell at a store in Soho called Tommy Guns, which was kind of blowing up at the time. And I said, look, I'm opening my own shop in the next 3 months. All I want is a chair to service my clients. He was like, sure. Cut hair there and then went out. And I had a, I'd lost
Tommy
my...
Tommy Guns was a very cool shop.
Yeah, that super in cool his own well. Point. Yeah, had yeah, yeah. It, that it, was blowing
suddenly,
up.
Suddenly had that kind of proper yeah. kind of shine to it.
Yeah, in Soho at the time, there was multiple boutique salons that were really cool.
Really flying.
Yeah, yeah, and we were kind of like, you know, there was Fish, Cuts, Tommy Guns. You know, there's a couple of other little things going on, but they were the main three. And I kind of, and I'd lost my best mate at the time, and my mate Martin Daly had died on a motorbike in an accident. And me and a mutual friend, a guy called Max, we kind of bonded over losing Martin, and he agreed to loan me the money to set my business up, and he was my business partner. So then this Cobblers on Peter Street became the Lounge Soho, and that opened in 98. And it was very industrial, like raw concrete, bare plaster, you know, barber's chairs, you know, it was...
I mean, it was very, very different. Yeah, you know,
it was completely...
You know, even yeah. Fish
yeah.
And Cuts and all that, they still looked very much yeah. like a kind of traditional bit of barbering.
Yeah, we had a big sofa area, we had PlayStations, we had sponsorship by Evian, so we had beers and water and
I mean, you
TVs
could almost be describing
wall.
Half a dozen shops that are opening yeah. up at the moment yeah. that are doing that with their yeah. Red Bull fridges and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was in 98.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, we had this kind of partnership with Sony that we were dealing with, and that was all cool. And me and my business partner, you know, he wanted his money out. I wanted my own business, and it worked. I was really fortunate. I opened that shop on day one on my own, just me. Didn't go after any of the Fish staff. I just thought, you know what, I'm going to make it work on my own. So I was in there on my own, shampooing, answering the phone, cutting hair. And out of the blue, these couple of lads walked in, a guy called Tim Pateman, who owns the Lion and Fox now. But Tim and another guy, I can't remember, it might have been Sean, came in and were like, we need a salon. And they'd worked in Covent Garden, and the shop they'd worked for gone under. So I was like, sure, great, come in. And they wanted to, so this whole self-employed employed model, they wanted to be self-employed. So in 98, I was doing that model. So I was like, great. And I'm like, great, I've got two people. And then four more turned up. And before you know it, all of the stylists that had worked at this store turned up on the door. And there were a guy called Max and Darren, you know, the great guys. And, you know, then Tim and Sean. And this team, I got gifted this team. And then off the back of that, you know, other people heard, and we got featured in Vogue. And
I would say Lounge really, I mean, my memory of it, Lounge took off.
Instantly.
Really did seem yeah. like an overnight thing.
Yeah, it was. Within 3 months, we were fully booked. Every chair was full. And I was really, really fortunate. I also did it slightly differently. So I knew that I needed public awareness, not within the industry, but externally. So I paid for a proper PR company. So we had a young Soho PR company that they got on board. So we were in all the magazines. We hit it slightly differently, pre-social media, obviously. So we had to be mindful of how you go about this. So my business partner left me to it. I cracked on, and that was it. And then,
but that wasn't, I mean, you know, you had things like kind of Michael John and Sassoons. You had those big established brands that you would see getting credits all over
yeah.
Vogue and yeah. so on. And for a tiny brand like yours to suddenly be properly kicking it through really was quite disruptive.
It was disruptive. And at the time...
Did you realize you were doing something different, or did it just there was a plan?
Yeah, yeah. I knew that we had to have a different kind of message. And I also knew that and this kind of follows through for quite a long time. I kind of didn't associate with the industry. having grown up doing hair competitions and all that kind of stuff, I realized that's not
that
who
was
I
opposite
was.
The opposite of what you wanted, yeah.
So I wanted to do something different. And my angle to it was that being featured in a hair magazine isn't going to put bums on seats. I need to be featured in Vogue or Elle or GQ or Arena or whatever the publication was, because that's what a client is going to read and then want to come to me. So I really kind of knew that I had to change the whole focus of what we were doing to make this work, because you're in a noisy space. Yeah. So what signifies you out from everyone else? And we really kind of hit it hard and worked really hard to get that right. Me and my business partner fell out, difference of opinion. You know, I wanted to push and expand and develop, and you know, he wasn't interested, and you know, that kind of ended quite sourly. You know, we haven't spoken for years. You know, I wish him well, but you know, that
I mean, relationship, it's not an unusual story. No, sadly.
It's like a marriage.
Yeah.
Business, anyone going into partnership with somebody else, you have to make sure you've got really clearly defined objectives, what you both want out of it. You both need to know your role. And
sometimes it just doesn't work out. Yeah. Some of you grow apart. And was Fish was still running?
Yeah, they were still
alongside. Was there any kind of reconciliation with you and Paul? Or did that?
Yeah. We bumped into each other at a wedding, shook hands, and that was cool. And I've seen him, haven't seen him recently, but pre-COVID, we bumped into each other at different things. And yeah, I've got no issues there at all.
And so, Lounge, going back to Lounge, was your proper first managing gig, owning.
Yeah.
Did you take to that well, or do you look back and think, I was a bit of a dick? Or did you nail it? Did you gain?
I think my management style at the time was completely wrong. Now. But at the time, it seemed it was the right thing. We'd all go out, partying. You know, we were all in each other's pockets. It was fairly blurred. Yeah, it was really blurred. And at the time, that seemed how you did it.
Mm.
And that's what I thought. You know, I'm cutting hair on the shop floor next to you. We're all going out tonight.
Yeah.
And looking back, now I sit there and I just go, Jesus, you know, what was I thinking? But at the time, that's what we all did. We lived hard, we worked hard, partied hard. Yeah. That was it. It was, we're in Soho, we're out, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. It was what it was.
And the Lounge lasted well. I mean, it wasn't an overnight success and a bubble that popped immediately.
No,
it had some legs on it.
Yeah, we had peaks and troughs. We had a couple of years that weren't great. Soho changed. Everyone moved east. You know, a lot of the big ad agencies and people that were our client base, they all moved east. You know, staff come and went. You know, you had to, you know, get a grip of it.
And did you take that well when your first lot of staff moved off? When people moved away and left you, did you take that okay at the time, or did you take it being that much of a family? Did your ego get bruised? Because I found it in the early days, I found it terribly kind of really difficult when people left.
I think some people I invested in,
mm.
and that's, I struggled with that. But I was also in the back of my mind aware that I'd left other shops to progress in my career. And that always came through in the end. Yeah. I might have initially smarted about it and been a bit pissed, but you know, I now look at everything as an opportunity, and that's only because of looking back over the years of, you know, we had the Lounge nearly, so we opened in 91, closed 3 years ago, so you know, a long time.
But along the way, you did the. Well, you decided to get your name on a building and open up Joe & Co.
Yeah, so what happened was that me and my business partner fell out, and I was I took it over on my own, and really I should have shut it down, or I should have, the amount of effort and the amount of money that I had to kind of put into turning the Lounge around. And I was fortunate that my girlfriend and then wife, Agatha, we worked together on the business, and her background was fashion magazines and photography and stuff like that. And I remember her early in us dating with the Lounge was like, you want to get a website? And I was like, what the fuck is a website? And she was like, oh, it's this thing, you know, we'll sit in our office and look at it. And I'm like, no one's going to choose a hairdresser off a website. It's, you know, I'm featured in Vogue this month. That's why they're coming. And she went, you'll be surprised. So she had a mate that's brother set up a holding page.
and we were one of the first people to have a website.
Do you remember they used to have counters on websites? Yeah. And I think when I did the same week, I got talked into it. And I think we were like 504 or something.
Yeah,
they were real. You could see how many websites existed.
Yeah, and we were the only one in the West End that had a website. And all of a sudden, we were getting all this work, and then we built more pages. And we really, you know, she was really good in the back room and supporting me, and also winding my neck in, because, you know, you go, right, we're going to go and do this now. And you'd be like, really? We want to do that? So, you know, we worked really well together in the business, and we really made the lounge a success. And, you know, changed the way I managed, changed the way I viewed the business. And then I had this thing that I wanted a barbershop, because we were 70-30 when we first opened in favor of men's haircuts. And gradually it got to 50-50 because we were really well known for our colors and the strength of our women's work. And the guys were getting pushed out. We didn't have appointments, and we had only a limited amount of space. I think we had 8 or 9 chairs at that point, and we were maxed. And I got offered a shop in East London, off of Shoreditch High Street. And me and Agatha and my friend Ian, who was a bit of a mentor at the time, went over to have a look at this space, and it was really fucking cool in East London. No one else was really over there.
I was
going to
say, it was right before anybody.
No one was over there. And we sat there and we looked at this space, and I was like, this is going to be sick. You know, I'm going to have a barbershop here, and I'll shoot backwards and forwards on my motorbike, and it'll be really cool. And we sat there with a nightclub clicker, like when you used to count people in.
Yeah.
How many people walked past that shop between 11 and 2 in the afternoon? And there was like, I don't know, a number of like 30 or whatever. And I was like, okay, footfall's shit. Drove back into Soho. And as we drove down Berwick Street, it was literally wall to wall. And Ian turned around to me and went, you want to open another one here? And I went, yeah. And then a shop literally around the corner from the lounge down the alleyway, Greens Court, a shop was available there. Same landlord, Westminster Council, did a deal. And then then Aggie got pregnant with my son, Milo. And so it got put on hold. So we had this shop, but we couldn't do anything with it. Sat on it for about 9-10 months, and then pushed the button on Joe & Co. And Joe & Co. opened. And a lot of people thought I was mental, because, hang on, why are you opening a shop around the corner?
I was going to say, it's like 3 or 4 minute walk.
It was four physical shops away.
Wow.
And I was like, we can feed it. The lounge is fully booked. Everyone knows the lounge. We're fully booked. Just around the corner, we've got a barbershop. And all of a sudden, we opened there, recruited really strong, strong people. A young lady called Hayley came to work for me. She was my lead barber. She was phenomenal. And built a team and hit the ground running. And, you know, had the first couple of years were really, really great, really strong. Had a situation where someone left. Took half the team, tried to steal the database, really messy. Took a year to rebuild off the back of that.
Wow.
Because I wouldn't accept anything less than the perfect people. So we're really specific about, I didn't want someone who'd just done a MBQ level 2 in barbering straight off the I wanted someone who had a hair and barbering background, understood fashion, could work with long hair, understood that where men's hair was going, but was prepared to learn how to do beards and shave and stuff like that, and literally run that. I probably put $100,000 into that business over the next year just to support it whilst I reset it and started again. And then that became, you know, that was great. We were maxed out there.
And this is early 2000s?
2010.
Yeah.
So 2009.
So right at the beginning, as you know, barbering or new barbering kind of really kicked off kind of 2012. So,
And then I was really fortunate that the same landlord again, Westminster, the big corner unit on Peter Street, which was in between me and the lounge, that became available. And I'd been after it for a while. It was double shop front, so it was a big corner space. It was massive. And I got it. And then I was like, Joe & Co's going in there. And then we're going to do something really, really special. And it was a massive space, really high ceilings. And we put we built it following the same design as the original Joe & Co. But in the middle, we put this massive table. And it was like loads of chairs around the table. So instead of having the lounge where you had somewhere to lounge around in with sofas, this was far more about having a like a central hub in the space. And yeah, you know, great. Killed it.
And did the networking continue in that place?
Yeah, because by then I was doing session work and I was starting to run around a lot and, you know, you got to meet people and, you know, you kind of, you know, you'd have different product brands that you would do different things with from time to time. You know, we were, you know, still really heavily focused on consumer press. So I was nominated GQ Barber of the Year. The shop was, you know, top five salons in the country, top five barbershops in the country, really focused on that, really focused on our websites. We worked with a really amazing design team called Hyperkit that I'm still keeping in touch with, but they did all my early shop design, web design, put a lot of money into our websites, got onto social media fairly early on, but were very specific about how we shop our clients. And actually today, I don't know if they're here, no, they're not. But I found an envelope of from 2009 Polaroids of all of our clients. Cool. We've just literally gone through and we're actually going to frame them and put them up in Wolf somewhere. But yeah, we were really focused on what we projected and how and the language we used would be very fashion knowledge, you know, forward thinking, you know, understood music, understood film, what was going on. You know, that was all part of the culture that we had across the teams and how we operated.
And how was your relationship with the industry at that stage?
Didn't exist.
So you'd stuck with just being, you were enjoying being an outsider.
I wasn't really known. I think people knew of the brands and other, you know, especially in London, I think I was known, but I hadn't, you know, not compared to where I am now, where I, you know, I've got to meet so many amazing people. I'm fortunate to enter competitions and judge and, you know, be far more involved. I was still consumer press focused because for me, it was about bringing brand awareness.
And you presumably you knew who your customer base was. And 100%. I think if you know where they are, you've got to find the marketplace to talk to.
Yeah, them. I could have described the Joe & Co client.
Yeah.
Where he shopped, where he drank, where he ate, what he bought, what he listened to, you know, within broad parameters.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, and our clients weren't that specific. They were quite,
Did that thought process come from, do you think that came from the kind of amalgamation of the kind of career? Because, you know, by this stage, you'd been, you know, you were pushing towards 20 years in the industry.
Correct, yeah.
You know, was that the full experience of it? Or were you taking example from anyone in particular or any area in particular?
I think it was what I saw. You know, you would, you know, having most of my working career in Soho, if not all of it, you saw what was on the street. You saw the people walking through the door, the people you spoke to, the relationships you were building, which is all about what all of us do in hair and barbering. It's all about the relationship. So you become very well informed. If you actually bother to think about what I'm seeing, if you actually take note of it, all the questions you have get answered. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
And even going back to those Polaroids, even today when I had a flick through them, there were faces that they weren't my clients at all. Like none of those pictures are my clients, but I could remember each of those people.
Yeah.
And I might have only had a touching moment with them here and there, but I remember those faces. So I think a lot of what I was trying to, you know, don't get me wrong. I had amazing support with my wife at the time, Agatha. I had a really, really good team behind the scenes, great PR, great design, great web development.
Was your team then all still self-employed?
We went through phases.
Did you change?
Yeah, we went through phases. We went through a big period of being self-employed. And then I remember having a salon manager and she was like, what's the point of me being here? I can't manage these people. And we sat down with the accountant at the time and went, what's the deal? And at the time,
and this is what, early 2000s,
yeah, VAT was 15%,
yeah,
you know, no minimum wage, you know, whatever. And we moved wholesale to being employed.
Wow.
And Joe & Co was employed and a few people left, didn't want it, you know, but we rebuilt and we then ran an employed ship all the way up to COVID. And that was, we were employed.
And in there, were you employing apprentices? Did you,
yeah,
did you bring in your
always, train, always.
You know, a lounge, but Joe & Co apprenticeship?
We had separate
idea?
Yeah, we had barbershop apprentices and we had lounge apprentices. Jade, my general manager at Wolf, she trained with me as a hairdresser at the lounge.
Oh.
Yeah.
And,
you know, and...
And do you see many of your apprentices around?
All the time. And it's really nice sometimes. I think I posted something when I shut the lounge and Joe & Co down. And there were loads of people that I'd, you know, people like Nick Stay, Edith, there was loads of people reached out to me. And I can't, in honesty, if you ask me how many apprentices I've employed, I can't give you a number. And that's not me being not thoughtful about it. There are names and there are people talk to me sometimes and go, oh, do you remember Marcia? She worked with us. And I'm like, can you remind me? Mm. And they'll describe and I go, oh my God, yeah. Or, you know, there's like, you know, there's standout people that I remember, like Lindsay was an assistant with me at Fish back in the day. And, you know, I remember lots of different people. Interestingly, when I shut the Lounge and Joe and Co down, people reached out to me going, best years of my life, loved it there, loved working with you, you know, and, you know, and that's really what I love about the whole apprenticeship route. And what, you know, and even looking at the people that I've got around me now, you know, I've got, you know, a handful of guys that I've trained that have gone through the Lounge and Joe and Co and now on the shop floor. There's a couple of people, there's someone's in Australia, someone, you know, that I don't necessarily keep in touch with directly, but via Instagram and stuff like that. So yeah, I've always heavily invested in my apprentices. Yeah.
I mean, I think that makes a huge difference. Like, you know, we just had our company Christmas party, yeah, and looking around the table, it was like, you know, so many of my team are homegrown, so many team, yeah, people have been around, and even our youngsters that are just qualifying, you're watching them fly. It's a really nice bit of the industry to have.
It is a really amazing part of the industry, and I think that, yeah, there's obviously a lot of talk about the last budget and what it means. You know, there's nothing in there for us as an industry whatsoever. And I do think that the fear is for me that apprenticeships will end in the next couple of years, mm, and all of the education is going to be based in colleges. Mm. And I think that, you know, the government is missing a trick by not supporting salons. And if you, you know, people outside of the industry may not realize that we don't get any financial incentives to employ an apprentice. Yes, you can put them on an apprentice salary. We never do. Ours are all on national minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, we support them and we do training in salon that costs the company money alongside training, mm, by an education provider. You know, there is, as a company, to have an apprenticeship scheme, it costs the business a lot of money. And you have to be sure that you're going to get something at the end of it.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that you're going to get something because these people have worked for you all year round. That's the misunderstanding. That for us to really invest in young people, you want to see them hit the shop floor. And maybe not with you, with somebody, yeah, else.
I mean, I think that's the difficult bit. I think that, you know, when everyone's running an apprenticeship scheme, then if one of yours goes up the road and does something else, then one of theirs will come. There was that flow,
yeah,
which seems to have... Well, it's in danger of drying out.
Yeah, and I think there is a concern that, you know, where does this go and how does this pan out? But, you know, I'd like to try and be as positive about it, mm, as I can. And, you know, I do think the apprenticeship route is definitely the best, yeah, way.
And it's a burden, but it's a very, you know, but equally there's some great payoffs at the end. Correct. when it does work. Sorry to interrupt, but I want to talk to you about something really important. Our podcast here is more than just about the industry, the barbershop and the life therein. It's about the community that we built. And in the time we've been doing this podcast, the community has been amazing and we've loved it. Now we're looking for you to get involved and become an essential part of our future. We're seeking long-term, mutually beneficial opportunities for partnership to come on board and help spread our message, to connect with our community, to help grow it, to keep the message strong, and to keep hearing and discussing these amazing topics that we do with all our guests. If you think your brand is the right brand for us, if you want to get in touch, please email me at thenoblebarberpodcast@gmail.com or DM me on Instagram. It'd be really good to talk to you. We'd love you to be part of our future. Okay, and now back to the episode. The Lounge is pumping.
Yep.
Joe's is cracking it.
Yep.
Had your link with the chain come along, Primark, with your product? Had that happened?
Yeah, I got... there was,
it, that kind, was really...
Yeah, that was a really bit left field.
Yeah.
Me and Agaton, my wife, we went through a breakup and a divorce, and I took over the businesses because we run them together, so I took them on. And I got approached for a meeting with Primark, and went with my girlfriend at the time, Deanna, and another friend, Viv, to go see what these this was all about. Mm. Went to head office. No, went to Oxford Street first, to a big office there, and sat down with the team. They basically said, look, we're opening this big, our biggest store in Europe. It's in Birmingham. It's in an old shopping mall. We want to put a barbershop in the menswear department. I was like, wow. And they already had it. So they'd already gone into conversations with somebody else who I don't know, and it didn't pan out for whatever reason. So they had a loose design and they were under construction. And it was a bit last minute. And I was a bit like, and they would go, we want to... And one of the guys who I still keep in touch with, Scott, he'd been having his hair cut in Joe & Co. That's why we got pulled into, and he knew who I was and what I was doing. And
still so many deals start in a barber's chair, don't they?
Always. It's a hustle. And they were like, yeah, we want to do Joe & Co. And I was like, no chance. I'm not putting...
So that was to be the barber shop in there was to be...
Yeah, and I was like, you're not having a premium brand Joe & Co. in Primark. There's no way it translates. So
that's got to be quite hard to stand your ground, because presumably there was great temptation to having this.
No, it was easy because I didn't know what I was getting into. So the thought of being able to walk away from it was quite straightforward. I was also, I'd also been approached by somebody who was doing a franchise deal with a European chain, and he wanted me to be involved. And all of a sudden I was like, hang on. I'll take this franchise vehicle, stuff it into Primark, because Primark were talking about doing a multi-store rollout very quickly. And I was like, great, I don't have to use my name, don't have to dilute what I'm doing, I'll just oversee it all. Anyway, that didn't add up. For lots of different reasons, that deal fell through really quickly. And then I turned around to him and said, if you want to do Primark with me, you can't use my name, Joe & Co., but you can use my surname, Mills. We'll do Mills times Primark. We'll do a collaboration. And we sat down, thrashed it out, met all the senior team very quickly, and all of a sudden we were in Birmingham looking at a fit out of a barbershop in Birmingham. We had, I think the original package was 12 barbershops in 18 months. And there was a lot of trepidation from me about how do I make this fucking work. Sat down, got everyone together, so got Charlie Cullen, Nicola was doing my HR at the time, my mate Adam at the time. There was room, probably about 15 people, sat everyone down and went, we're going to brainstorm this. What does it look like? What does it mean? How are we going to make it work? How do we run it? How do we train teams of barbers back to back to back? How do we roll this fucker out? Excuse my language. How do we make all this? How do we make this work? And does it work? Thrashed it through for a day, literally sat round a table for a day thrashing it through, and went, okay, I can do this. This is what's
next.
This
is to magic up 60 barbers.
How do we do this? How do we make it work? How do we formulate it? You know, Charlie and me were talking about education and, you know, what do we do? And me and Charlie hadn't really started working together then, but we were on the cusp of. Jodie Taylor was in the background somewhere as well at that point, and there was a lot of really cool stuff going on. And then Primark sprung it on me that I had to have a coffee shop in the front of the barbershop. And they sold it to me on the footfall that they projected. And the footfall was that we were right by the main entrance or one of the entrances. And there would be all these thousands of people walking in. And the coffee shop, we sat down with their head of beverages and food. And he was like, oh, you're going to make X amount of money a day in coffee. And we were like, hang on, the coffee shop makes way more money than a barbershop and actually pays for the rollout. Wow. If the numbers are right, this pays for the rollout. This is a no-brainer. Wow. So I went back up to Birmingham. We had we started recruiting barbers and doing like trade testing, and Primark gave us a space to do that. We started finding these young guys. And at that point, Leon Campbell came on board, who's at Babyliss, and, you know, he came on board, you know, Brother Barber, came on board. He was going to be the main guy there. And I was like, fuck, I'm literally, this is great. Went to Starbucks, found went to a couple of independents and Starbucks and Costa, and went, that barista is absolutely killing it. Great personality, poached people, put them in the coffee shop, let's go. And we opened. And then 4 weeks after that, we opened Manchester. it was really, really pressurized. And
you're still doing two stores in Soho.
And still doing session work and flying everywhere and running around and doing everything, yeah. And being a single parent then at that point, me and Aggie had separated, divorce was going through, doing week on, week off as a single parent with my son. So yeah, really
intense. It's had a stress knocking around there.
Hell of a lot of stress. And equally coming out of the marriage was really, really hard for me. Mm. It wasn't great for either of us. But it was a very low point for me and really struggled with my mental health through that. But I had loads of great people around me and knew that it would pass, and it did. Primark opened, did Manchester, then we're doing Liverpool next. And I'm like,
and you got a range, you got a product range going.
That point was a conversation that didn't happen for the first year, but we were doing that. And then I realised that there was an issue with the Primark gig. Soho was killing it, but I was cutting myself into pieces trying to get from one, And I realized that the Primark concept, it was flawed. The coffee shop didn't hit anywhere near the targets we had, and we shut the coffee shop element of it down. And I wanted to potentially put vinyl in there or something like that and utilize that space differently. And the reason being was that I got caught up, and I can talk about it now a lot more happily, but I got caught up in middle management bullshit. Because as a young entrepreneur and anyone who owns their own business, you can make decisions on the hoof. You can make a decision tomorrow that you're going to open on Sunday, or that you're going to employ five more people or close it or do whatever you want. But when you're within a bigger machine, other people get involved. I was very, very supported by a lot of the very upper team. And Scott, I'm seeing next week for a drink. Amazing people, but their hands were tied to a certain degree. But we realized very quickly that people didn't know that we existed within the store. And we can't control that. We don't control what's on the tannoy. We don't control your point of sale. We don't control the flow of people around your store that you've designed. And when we had Manchester, it was in the middle of the menswear department. And a lot of people didn't even know there was a barbershop there. So we had to really, really push. And I said that I'm not opening any more stores until we get this right. So people know that we exist and know that we're here. And we were just in the process of really addressing that. And we stumbled into COVID. And then everything changed.
So at that point, where we're all going into COVID, you had two very successful Soho shops,
right?
And another career. doing session work and everything else. All of that went. And on top of that, you've got two stores in Primark open. Yeah. Third one supposedly on its way.
Yeah, on ice, but ready to go. Yeah.
Tough gig, mate. I mean, none of us enjoyed Primark and enjoyed COVID, but to be dealing with all of that. Tough little run.
Yeah, but you know what it is as well? I for a long time, only worked 6 day weeks, took 2 weeks holiday a year. Mm. Even when I first had Mila, I was always grafting and, traveling and doing this and doing that and working nights and whatever it took. Partly because I wanted it. And also that's what identified me as me. What do? I cut hair. Oh, where do you work? I've got my own shops. Oh, so you're an entrepreneur. Oh, yeah, I guess I am. I do session work. Cutting hair is what identified me. So walking into COVID, I remember about a month out of, and there was stuff coming out of China and out of Italy. And I was like, there's a shit show coming. And I remember we were wiping chairs down and all of that long before we got told to, and that whole thing. And I remember there was a client in the shop in Joe & Co, and I was cutting hair on the shop floor, and he was coughing. And I turned around and went, dude, what are you fucking doing? And he was like, and his mate actually, he was like, and I was like, you come in here, everyone's freaking out about COVID. And he goes, well, I haven't got it. And I went, we don't know that. Anyway, I kicked him out. And, we had words and it was fine. And, he's still a mate and he still gets his haircut. But, and then we walked into COVID. And I think for the first month, it was literally I'd get up every morning, I'd have my breakfast, I'd have my coffee, go down to the office, sit with my laptop, and I'd be on the phone to HMRC or to this person or that person, or trying to manage this, understanding what the bounce back loans were. Was there any support from Barclays? Where was I exposed? It was full time. So it didn't feel like.
And presumably, you got most of your team at this point, are they all still
furloughed.
Everyone furloughed. Were you keeping in touch with your team through this? Because that's a large number
Zooms.
Of people by then.
We were doing weekly Zooms.
Right.
Everyone on. What's everyone up to? For definitely by month two, definitely.
And Westminster Council, Westminster landlords, were they great? I mean, I've heard lots that they were incredibly supportive for companies.
Really supportive. They had funding in place really quick.
And Primark?
Yeah.
It wasn't costing you at that point.
No, not at all. And it was on ice. That's it. Done.
And so for most people, a lot of people, probably myself included, the first furlough, we kind of enjoyed it. The first 3 months, it was the biggest time off I'd had since I was a school kid on summer holidays. And it gave me a chance to look and think about my business in a different way.
Yeah.
How was it for you in the middle of a shit show anyway?
I remember the night we closed and posting something on social media and feeling really scared about not knowing what was to come. Not the fact that there was COVID, I wasn't scared about that, but not knowing what this meant, that someone has told me I've got to shut my business and I'm doing it. What the fuck? Like, this is really out of my control. And that was an enormous thing for me. And I remember going home and being a bit like, where's the wine? I'm going to sit and trash a bottle of wine. And then the next day going, okay, well, let's get proactive. So I think for the first month, it was far more about setting up furloughs, payroll, making sure we had money in the bank. Yeah. Where were we? What was going on? You know, was the landlords happy? You know, all of that. And then month two or three, you know, baking banana bread, opening a bottle of wine up when Boris comes on at five. You know, well, what can we cook?
But did you find during that period that you started viewing your businesses differently? You changed your relationship with your businesses?
Not initially.
Because you obviously made, you know, I'm leading towards the next big change that happened for you.
Yeah. So I think initially I was just wanting to go back.
Right.
And I'd cycle from where I was living in King's Cross, where I live now, down to Soho, and the roads would be, you know, like weird, 28 days later. You know, it's literally like a zombie movie. And, you know, it was all a bit weird. And, you know, it was okay. Then when we reopened, Primark put me on ice. Because the initial reopening was about people in a space and bubbling and stuff like that. And they said, we can't have the barbershop open with potential clients because that limits the amount of people on the rest of the space. So we were closed, and we were closed for another 6 weeks. And then they turned around and went, we're going to close you. And I was like, okay, well, how does that look? So then we got caught up in a long negotiation so that I came out of it okay. The product range had come out at that point, and we were in, you know, there was lots of things done. And I spent a lot of time going to head office and then going to Ireland as well for the final meetings. And we finished that relationship with a handshake. I was very happy. They were happy, and that was good. Then I had to focus on Soho.
And all the staff had gone. No, all the... The staff was
yeah, we let people go that had to. And when we knew that we weren't opening straight away, I was very, like, I was doing Zoom meetings with them as much as I was with my London team. And we were very clear about, I'm sorry, but we're not opening now if you want to go somewhere else because you want to, you know, get back to earning.
And the furlough had finished for that when...
Yeah.
They were just...
Yeah. So we had to wind that up. And it was what it was. And you know, we handled it as best we could.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the support of Primark, and we got that done. And then I was just like, okay, let's focus on Soho. So we reopened under the same restrictions as everybody else, followed the guidelines, whizzed all the way through with the mini lockdown through to that big Christmas lockdown. Yeah. And then at that point, I think I was starting to feel the pressure of what am I doing? Like, this is like trying to manage people, trying to manage expectations, you know, understanding what the requirements were on us as a business. We walked into that lockdown, and I went to Soho to the lounge. Like, it was it was probably like the mid to end of February. Cycled down there, popped into the shop, and I had a flood. And I was like, shit, where's this water coming from? And it was coming from the apartment above. So I got hold of Westminster Council, and we had this parquet flooring that was beautiful that had all risen and buckled and was ruined. Anyway, I was like, okay. So anyway, I came back the next day, and I could hear water running downstairs in the basement. And I was like, hang on, what's this? And luckily, I didn't die, but I walked down a metal staircase into waist-deep water. And that's where all the electricity boards were. So luckily, it hadn't hit the boards because the whole thing would have been live. So I walked down, realised that fucking there's water everywhere and it's coming through the wall. So shut all the power off, call the fire brigade. They come, they're pumping it out. We're trying to work out what on earth's going on. And it turns out that there was a burst water main in the street and it popped through my wall. And it took... from the start, from identifying it to reopening that space was 9 months. And we were battling with Thames Water, Westminster Council, British Gas, Highways people, and my insurance company. So I was fortunate that I had three spaces. I had the big corner Joe & Co. I had the little shop in the alleyway that was the original Joe & Co. and the lounge flooded out. And what, in hindsight, what I should have done is when, well, the lounge is shut and gone after the insurance companies. Yeah. But I had a group of people that I really loved and respected that were my stylists, and I had my clients. So what I did was I moved the lounge into the corner shop, which was Joe & Co, and that became the lounge. And I moved Joe & Co into the old Joe & Co, so I could keep both those brands running and keep everyone working. And in the meantime, managed the shit show that was an insurance claim from health. Because I managed to keep them trading, I got paid out less. Mm. And I don't think it even broke even on the payout looking back, you know, not even including the amount of stress I went through. And I remember, so during COVID, I was doing like all session work and all that kind of stuff ended. And I bought a van and I converted this van into a mobile barbershop. So I had a barber's chair, water. My mate Adam Rogers, his team down in Margate at A1 Autos, they built and fitted this van out for me. Good it boys. Was the nuts. It was absolutely so cool. And it's actually still exists. The guy bought it and has a mobile barber service with it. And in the back, you had space where you could, like, you know, we could do shoots with it because it was fully separate. So you could have someone come to you. You didn't have to mix with anyone else. So anyway, I had this van and it was all vinyled up. It was super cool. And I was living in Farnham at the time when I had my son, and I was driving home to pick him up and like from school. So I, you know, it's like two o'clock and I'm on the N3 giving the van some welly, and on the phone I've got Westminster Council, my insurance company, some other assessor from Thames Water. And I really remember literally crying and having this conversation going, you don't understand what this is doing to me. You, like, to you guys, this is all a fucking joke. And feeling completely broken that I was getting nowhere with this, trying to get this thing resolved. And we were, it was probably like, you know, 3 or 4 months in. It wasn't even like towards the end. And I was broken. I was having panic attacks. I was really, really struggling to hold it together and still trying to be there for my son and for my partner at the time, you know, for Deanna and you know, looking up, making sure my ex-wife's all right and everything else. It was all well, well too much. Anyway, got through that whole process and reopened Joe & Co. in the lounge's space. I thought, you know what, lounge can stay there. I'm not moving it. We'll refurb this one as a brand new Joe & Co. Let's go. Reopened and opened in the September.
So the insurance company had paid for...
eventually, yeah.
So that was paid for insurance.
Yeah.
Got and you that were back store. To three working
back
spaces.
Back to three. I took the little shop back as a studio for myself and I put myself in there. Great, we're good. Then started training. You know, where Jody was working with, Charlie was there, Tarak was doing a day. You know, we had a really, like, it was, we were killing it. It was good. Numbers were good. Lounge was good. The girls and boys were happy in the lounge in the corner space. Joe & Co. felt like they got a new shop. They hadn't been shortchanged. Everything was good.
And mentally for you, are you doing done. Okay done. At this point?
No, I'm done.
I mean, it's just been
I don't think 15
rounds of battering, really.
I don't think I realised how much all of that and, you know, going through the divorce and all of the different things and Primark and...
Especially you know, the, your marriage was very intertwined with 100%. With your whole formative career.
Yeah, there was a lot going on. I was really fortunate that Deanna, my now wife, was super supportive through all of this process. And everyone else was as well. Mm. You know, my ex was supportive. You know, everyone was there going, you're all right, you're all right.
But you've never struck me as someone who's naturally going to ask for help.
Oh, no, I do.
You do?
Yeah, I've done 12 years of therapy.
And, but at that point, you were okay to put your hands up and,
100%.
And ask. And when you ask, everyone was there.
In their own way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different people have different ways. Mm. But I felt very supported. But it didn't mean that inside my head, it wasn't a hard space to be. You know, that, you know, it's, you know, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make it drink. Mm. You know, and I felt very much like I was, you know, I had my own struggle. And, but, you know, it was always that guy that was there for everybody else. Mm. So found a way to make it work. And it was only when it didn't work, which is when I closed everything, that I realized where I was at. Mm. The shops were doing well. Numbers were good. Money was good. You know, we were making profit, had some historical HMRC debt that was swilling around. Funding Circle that we took some investment on, they were swilling around and it was all building up. And then I had a situation, so I was on holiday in the summer before we closed at the Christmas. I was on holiday in the summer and there was a situation between someone who works in one shop and someone who works in the other. Basically, they started seeing each other and it turns out that there was an ex on the scene that had the raving arse and started making threats to the businesses while I was away. So I had to put 24-hour security on the shop because it was legit. And the financial impact on that, on the business and also on me, I remember sitting, my son was in the pool. I was sitting there having a coffee, like 8 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, what the fuck am I doing this shit for? I don't want to do this anymore.
The final straw that just
and
cracked it.
I came back and I made a decision then that I was closing the businesses that Christmas. I was going to put them into administration, deal with what I had to deal with. I'm done.
And this is kind of like a 3-month lead time or something.
Yeah, I'm done. Don't want to do it anymore. Huh. I'm going to just do my session work. I'll set my agency up. Don't want to do it anymore. Yeah. Don't want to be responsible for all this anymore. And it really, really hit me hard. And I jumped into I started doing double therapy sessions. My doctor was really good. I definitely had a level of depression. Wasn't really sure where I was going. The enormity of closing down these businesses was really weighing on me. Primark was done and dusted. And at that point, I then felt relieved that was done and dusted. But the Soho thing was really playing on me. And I was kind of trying to really find my feet about where I was going to go. And then the idea of Wolf King's Cross came up. And the space became available and I came into the space and I was looking at it, thinking about what could we do here? And it reminded me of years ago, there was a book called Hair Icons and there was a guy in there called Leonard who built a salon, House of Hair. And I was walking around Wolf and I was like, wow, there's something cool I could do here. And I sat down with my wife.
Soho's still open at this point.
Yeah. Still umming and ahhing about what I'm doing. Sat down with my wife and I was like, I want to do another project. And she was like, you're fucking mad. And I was like, I know, but I think I know what I'm doing this time. Like, not that I didn't in the past, but I'm doing it for the right reasons.
It was a kind of moment of clarity.
Yeah. And I was spent a lot of time in here, like in Wolf, in the different areas, thinking about how I'd make it work. And
what was in this building?
It belonged to a record label, Big Life, and they'd sold out. Yeah, they'd sold out. And the actual studio that we're now, both this one and the room next door, were actually sound studios. Okay. So they are soundproof, the doors are triple thickness, stuff like that. Wow. So we had to refurb the whole space. Mm. And she sat down with me and she was like, if this is what you want to do, go and do it. But, you know, commit to it. And I was like, okay. So I gradually brought the whole concept together and thought about it. Didn't know what we were going to call it. We didn't know what we were going to call it until just before we opened, actually. And then decided that Soho was going to go, and then spoke to everybody in the team, told them why. Had this meeting one night where everyone that I needed to tell that I was moving to King's Cross, I told, and we did one-on-one. I had each person individually. I spent time with the guys that were self-employed at the Lounge and Joe and Co. and said, this is what I'm doing. And then I sat down with everybody, and there was like maybe 40 people in the room one evening, got some beers and pizza, and kind of sat there and was really open and vulnerable and said, you know, I'm at breaking point. I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do it anymore. This is why I'm doing this. I'm doing this, and this is a journey I'm going on. If you want to come with me, you're more than welcome. If you don't, I understand. But this is what I'm doing. And it was really interesting. Wholesale, everybody was like, we've got you, which kind of was quite humbling, but also kind of reinforced that I knew what I was doing. So that was that. And we closed the Lounge in Soho on the 23rd and 24th of December. And those companies went into administration, and that dragged on, and it's, you know, that's still with
but
that.
Just keys locked up and yep. given back and yep. walked away from them completely.
Yep. And
a happy day in the end, or was it a relief? Was it heartbreaking?
All of the above. Yeah. All of the above. And I think that if I wasn't going on to do another project, which, you know, I was invested in, if I wasn't doing that, it would have had a different impact on me that would have lasted longer. Because there is that way that I touched on earlier about how you identify as who you are. You know, people, and I'm not talking about this specifically from a gender perspective, but 9 times out of 10, and I think especially men of our age and slightly younger, someone goes to you, what do you do there, mate? Oh, I cut hair, I'm a barber. Or I work in I'm in IT, or whatever it may be. You are identified by what you do.
Yeah.
That is your badge. That's your badge, whether you like it or not. You know, you are what you do. And that's only part of you as a person, but that's how you're identified. Mm. And I think for me, I was clearly tethered to these two shops, clearly tethered to those two brands. I wasn't opening Joe & Co. somewhere else. I was, they're done.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they were well-known brands. Mm. People knew them. People still go to me, oh, you had the Lounge, didn't
you? But it feels like almost, you know, certainly at the time, I mean, I've been through a similar thing with my previous business. It feels like you're kind of, you know, it's like you're losing an arm. There's a bit of your DNA in those rooms. The structural buildings. It's
almost
weird,
like it's a child.
It's that emotional connection that you have to
And also as well, there was separation as well, because I'd done those businesses with my ex-wife, Agatha, and that marriage has ended, and now those businesses have ended. So there's a lot of finals in that. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, Wharf opens.
Yeah.
And then it's mental, like crazy town. You know, we're up in the King's Cross.
But you feel now, emotionally at this point, gone? Does it feel like a new breath of air? Do you feel like you've got, you know, new wind in you?
I got interviewed just before the Wharf opened. I think it might have been Creative Head or one of the magazines. And I was right in the middle. We had builders on site. It was all fucking crazy. And I remember thinking, well, I remember the interviewer saying to me, are you bonkers? And I said, most people my age are winding down, not winding up. I'm accelerating. I know what I'm doing now. You know, this is my new, I'm up for this. And I really felt that this was, you know, I felt in a strong place from one perspective, but still quite vulnerable in another. Where I am today is the most happy I've been for many, many years.
And Wharf is coming up 5 years old?
No. 3 years old.
3 years old.
Three years old in January.
You wouldn't expect that, would you? It feels so established and so kind of now.
No, we're in our third year, coming into our third year. So, you know, I don't know when this comes out, but, you know, 3 years in January, end of January, 2026. So, yeah, so.
But it is this kind of, you know, that renewed energy. I mean, I've been there with you. It is that positiveness that comes out of you again about this.
I think the word positive is definitely true, but I think it's more resilient. I think I've gone through and I can look back through all of the different chapters of my life and, you know, look forward to the new chapters that are going to come with a level of positivity that I can get through it, you know. And, you know, someone said something the other day to me about they were avoiding doing something, and the thought of that is often harder than the actual doing that thing. And I think that, you know, how I look at everything now is everything is an opportunity. You know, I am 56, I'm 57 next year. I am thinking about what the last part of my life looks like. We had this conversation a little while ago about if I've got 20 good summers left in me, yeah. Well, 20 good summers isn't long. So what am I going to do to enjoy those 20 summers? So I'm far more focused about the back half of my life in a positive way, not a negative way, making sure that I'm there for the people that are important to me, but also within my business as well, you know, treating it for what it is in the right way and with respect and managing it to the best of my ability. But I think what I'm lucky with Wolf, and I'm lucky with this in lots of aspects of my life. We've obviously got the agency, do a lot of consultancy for other people inside the industry and outside the industry. And I've got Wolf and I'm a session stylist, but none of that happens. Yes, it is my ideas and yes, it's my making, but it's about all the people around me. You know, if it isn't for the front of house team, Jade and the front of house team at Wolf, Betty, who runs the agency, looks after all my social media. She's phenomenal. If it wasn't for Hugh, my bookkeeper, my accountants, my lawyers, you know, my wife, who isn't actively involved in the business, but supports everything I do.
But I think that's a huge thing that gets forgotten, that actually
it's not me.
You know, we may be the kind of, you know, the hub of the wheel, but it's everyone else that's keeping it going around.
Yeah.
And you are supportive. I think certainly conversations with other business owners out there, you know, you've got to remember it's not everything's on you. There's plenty of people there to share it with.
I've just come, so if you think about, so we're coming like early December today. Realistically, the last 11 days I was traveling on a job. I was back in London maybe a few days before that, where I was in and out of work. Before that, I was on a job for 15 days. Before that, I had to look after a mate for 5 days. Before that, I was on another job for 11 days.
So you start to take it easy now, are you?
No, but those blocks of time, yeah. I'm not running my business. I'm overseeing it and I'm being asked questions, but I'm not putting the key in the door. I'm not switching on the lights and I'm not doing the banking.
Yeah.
I rely enormously on a group of people to make that happen, and then enormously on all of the employed and self-employed people that are around me doing what they do. And if it wasn't for all of those, none of this would work.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful to all of those people that believe in what we do and why we're doing it. Otherwise, you're right, the hub isn't a wheel, it's just a central piece. So we're really, you know, I'm really fortunate, and I often talk about we, and I, you know, because it's not me. You know, the session work and me doing that, that's me.
Yeah.
Cutting hair in the shop, that's me. But all the other stuff relies on a, you know, what is it? It takes a village to raise a, yeah. Yeah.
No, it's true. And you get a great feeling in stores that have got this team. And I think the word team's thrown around an awful lot, especially with companies that are essentially entirely self-employed workforce,
I employ a team of people and I have a load of collaborators who work.
Yeah. And I think that's where the team dynamic really works, when you've got people invested in it.
Yeah.
Obviously session work has been part of you since you were 22, 23.
Yeah, I was lucky I got into it quite early on.
The fact that right at the beginning of your barbering career you were doing politicians and journalists. There seems to have been this kind of celebrity mecca that's been on your doorstep for most of your career.
Yeah, I've been lucky. I think I treat everyone as I don't care who you are. I treat you all the same. I've been really fortunate. I've got a great opportunity, met the right people, and hustled fundamentally. You know, nothing comes easy. You have to hustle for it.
But you're very successful in your session career.
Yeah.
Which is enough for most people. You've got a great business, you've got your session. And then, I don't know, I'll have the Joe Mills agency.
Yeah.
How? What provoked? Why?
To disrupt.
Because this is quite a new baby, though, isn't it?
This is 18 months ago. Yeah. So we opened Wolf and then literally straight off the bat dropped the agency as well. The idea of the agency was, I've never had an agent. I've been invited to what we call go cities, where you go and have meetings with someone. So I've been invited to loads of different agencies, all of the big ones, and they all want to know how much you're billing. Great, we're going to take 30% of that. And I'm like, well, that's work I've already got. Why am I going to give you 30% of that? Well, that's how it is. We're going to manage your diary. Well, I've got the front of house that manages my life. I don't need you to manage my diary. We'll do your invoices. I've got in-house bookkeeping. Why are you going to do my invoices? None of it made sense. And I was very comfortable looking after my own business.
Yeah.
Fast forward on, you know, everyone moans about their agent and, oh, they're shit, they're useless. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to set my own agency up. We mentor and support people that want to come into the industry. I'm honest about the industry, which a lot of people aren't, that you will do lots of work for nothing. You will give a lot of your time up for nothing. It won't necessarily be the most creative work you do, but you'll get a lot of enjoyment out of it if you choose to commit to it. You have to be prepared for that. So I'm very truthful about that. And we only take 20% commission, which we charge to the client on work we deliver. Don't manage diary day in, day out. Work comes to us, we hunt for work for you and we option you, but we support you through the whole process, which for me, it doesn't have to make money. And I know this sounds really crazy. As long as it wipes its face, then it sits alongside the brand that's Wolf and it sits alongside the brand that's me, I guess. But it, for me, it wasn't about it making, you know, I'd love for it to make profit and we've had a good year this year, so hopefully we will. But, you know, it wasn't about that. It was more about the bigger picture thing. Yeah. And also, you know, I've got a couple of guys, you know, like Richard, who's on my agency. I've mentioned him a few times in different things, but, you know, he's a phenomenal hairdresser, ex-Feed Assassin. Came to me and went, I want to do what you do. I'm like, okay, cool. Same as Kai Wilson. Like, Kai's on the agency. I taught Kai how to do skin. I taught Richard how to do skin. I taught Charlie Cullen how I do skin. Charlie's gone off to be very successful on his own as well. You know, and, you know, Kai is going to Paris next year to do Dior with Jamie Dornan. Mm. You know, Kai's done jobs for me this month that I can't do. Richard now is really, like, he came in the other day and he was like, fucking exhausted, I'm just nonstop. And I went, you asked for it? And he went, yep. And that's the truth. Yeah. You know, that. So that's how it works. And we try to encourage, you know, like, people that want to do what we do, then we look for a path to get them to that space.
But you've gone now 40 years coming up, I guess. 38, 39?
No, it's 40.
There you go. 56. Sorry, you look very upset. That
no, I was thinking it wasn't enough, but it is 40, 41 years, yeah.
You know, and you know, it's been a real ride. It's great. One thing that I've quite enjoyed about getting to know you, the last couple of years, really, is that you've got a good enthusiasm for the industry. I didn't know you back in the Joe days, and I managed to miss all that stressful period. But you're still trying to give back a little bit to the industry, which we talk about a lot, about younger barbers, yep, younger people in their careers and how they're making those decisions. Is that, I don't know if enjoyable is the right word, but
it is.
But do you feel personal achievement from helping out? What's in it for you? Because you're not really billing these younger companies.
So what you're talking about is the consultancy stuff I do. Yeah. So I'm really, really fortunate that if you can imagine it, I've probably been through it, same as you. Okay. So, and then what I've found is that a lot of young people a lot of people full stop in, yeah, not only our industry, but outside our industry, have come to me and gone, I need some advice. I need some help. What would you do? How do I do that? And I gladly give my time. If they're in a position to pay me, happy days. I do work outside of the industry where I do charge decent money for, so allows me to give up a certain amount of my normal time for nothing. And the idea is that I want to be able to give people the advice that I didn't have or that I wasn't able to get. And I would lay there with sleepless nights worrying about, what I was going to do about that member of staff or payroll or rent, or should I expand or should I contract? And I had no one to go to because it wasn't available. And being able to have, you know, someone call me up going, what do I do about this? And me be able to go, look, if it was me, this is what I would do. If you want to talk about it, I'm here for you. Or for someone to go, I want to change my business model. How did you do it? How do you do it? What would you recommend? I actually do get a lot of enjoyment out of that. And I actually, yes, I don't have loads and loads of free time, but I'm gladly give time up to spend time with people going through that, because it's important, because I do really, really care about the industry and I do really love the industry and what I do. For me, it is a lifestyle. And I know that sounds really wanky sometimes, but it's about the community and it's about the lifestyle and all that. You have to want to do this job.
Yeah.
If you don't love it and you don't want to do it, it's a really fucking tough gig.
Yeah.
And for me, it's, you know, it's important to me that people are in it for the right reasons. Mm. And if I can help someone get through a dark patch or answer a question, you know, because often you can't see the wood through the trees. And that's what's really scary, that you wake up some days and you're like, whoa. Yeah. And, you know, I may not have all the answers, but I've probably got most of them.
Yeah.
So for me, the consultancy thing, I love doing, and it's really important to me.
But you've become much more a kind of industry name now and an industry figure. Are you feeling kind of statesmanly in all of this these days now?
You know what it is? Like, we bumped into each other at the BHAs, and I was very fortunate. I was invited to go to the BHAs, and I do judge the BHAs. I bump into a lot of people there that I only see at awards, do's, or judging.
Right.
Like, you know, there's all sorts of different people from hair and barbering. And it's lovely to see everybody and say hi and how are you doing and all that kind of stuff. And I feel welcome. I feel included. Okay. And for a long time, out of choice, I didn't engage in that. The reason I did was when I did Primark, was like, I need to kind of let people know who I am and what I'm doing. And that's the reason that started. And now it's far more important to me than what it was then.
Yeah.
Now it's because this is my industry and this is, and I want to be included. So, yeah.
Well, I think that feels like a really nice time to stop.
Right.
Joe, thank you so much for sharing, mate. I really appreciated that.
I really enjoyed it.
I hope there's been some great words of wisdom in there. And if you are in the midst of a forest and all you can see are trees, please remember that there is a very bright new sunshine coming up afterwards. I'm here at King's Cross, at Wolf King's Cross, and it is glorious. And Joe and co and the lounge are just lovely, fond memories.
Correct.
And that's always the way. Thank you very much for listening. I've been Anthony Laban, and we've been the Noble Barber Podcast.
Welcome to the Noble Barber Podcast. We're always looking for interesting people and interesting stories. If you know someone or you are someone with a great story that you want to share, get in touch and come join me on the sofa. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you next time.